This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Bewilderness, Part 1, Threshold. Written by Jonathan Mayberry. Performed by Shayna Small.
Prologue. Now, the world was broken. It burned as it died. Abby Corman lay there, sprawled on a cracked floor littered with broken glass, melting wires, twisted metal. Long yellow fingers of flame clawed at the walls, while thunderclouds of dense smoke roiled against the ceiling. There was blood on the floor, on the walls, on her hands. People she knew, people she cared about, lay in silent heaps, like islands in a sea of spilled crimson.
"I'm sorry,"
whispered Abby. It was all she could manage. Not that anyone could hear her. Alarms tore the air. Warning lights pulsed red, turning the smoke into something hellish. In the distance, Abby could hear gunshots. Fewer now than before. And screams. So many screams.
"I'm sorry,"
she said again. Outside, all across the heart of Manhattan, the city was burning.
"I'm so sorry."
Part 1. Storm Warning. Modern science says the sun is the past, the earth is the present, the moon is the future. From an incandescent mass we have originated, and into a frozen mass we shall turn. Merciless is the law of nature, and rapidly and irresistibly we are drawn to our doom. Nikola Tesla. Chapter 1. The Pierce Tower, 20th floor, 48th Street and 7th Avenue, Manhattan, 9 hours earlier.
"Well," said Rosa Rodriguez, "it could be worse. The whole thing could blow us to atoms."
Dr. Abby Corman raised her head out of the open access panel in the floor. Her hair was in disarray and gunked with grease, and she had coolant on her face, neck, and lab coat. The coolant had already soaked through onto the blouse she'd worn specifically for today's presentation. Best case scenario was that she'd look like a homeless person.
"You," she said, "are fucking hilarious. No, wait. What I meant to say is that you can kiss my behind."
Hey, now, said Rosa, who was sitting cross-legged on the floor beside the hatch, cradling a cup of coffee between her palms. She was 25, curvy, almost always happy, and next to Abby's boyfriend, David, the person Abby trusted the most in the whole world. "We're supposed to be on our best behavior today for our visitors. Don't want them to think we're a bunch of mad scientists."
Abby used the back of her wrist to wipe gook from her cheek, frowned, sighed, and fished in her toolbox for a pair of wire cutters. She was in her early 30s, but still looked like her college graduation photo. Pale and skeptical green eyes and a medium brown face that was an exact genetic split between her white father and black mother. Both of them had been scientists too. Had been. Before a rainy night on a busy turnpike had taken them away from her. Now her family was David and Rosa, and the Gateway Initiative. "We are scientists," Abby said, "and right now I'm pretty mad." Rosa sipped her coffee.
"Mad because you spent 2 hours trying to find a problem that turned out to be a big nothing burger? Or mad because two senators are coming to poke their noses into everything and maybe cut our funding if they don't like what they see?"
"Both," said Abby, as she stripped the plastic coating off a wire.
"Yeah, well, both control the purse strings," said Rosa, "and we have been picking their pockets for a while now. That's why Dr. Benjamin gave us that whole speech about putting on a good show."
"Dr. Benjamin can also kiss my shh," cautioned Rosa, though she was laughing. She lowered her voice and leaned forward.
"You know the walls have ears."
Abby tossed the cutters into the toolbox and began hand-twisting wires together.
Walls can kiss my ass, too. And now you're sexually harassing inanimate objects.
Abby shook her head and then sealed the splice with thick electrical tape. She leaned on the edge of the panel opening, accepting the container of coffee Rosa handed her. For a moment, the two women said nothing. Each was smiling, but at different wattages. Rosa, who was Abby's senior technician for the project, looked faintly amused by everything. Office politics never seemed to get under her skin. She was a PhD candidate from Cornell and as sharp as a razor. Abby, on the other hand, had been a prodigy in math and physics. She graduated from high school at 13, and that same year won the gold medal in the International Physics Olympiad. She blitzed her way through undergraduate and master's degrees and received her PhD from MIT at age 20, with Dr. Arnold Benjamin as her thesis advisor. She stayed at MIT to take a postdoctoral teaching position, but left a year later when Benjamin received the grant to begin building Gateway. "You know Dr. B is going to want you to stick to the timetable," said Rosa after a few quiet minutes. "He made all those promises to the last senators who were here."
"I know," said Abby, wincing at the memory.
"He wants to test fire tonight and then go full tilt as soon as possible."
Rosa finished her coffee and did a hook shot toward the trash can by the door. It missed by an inch. She shrugged.
"Maybe as early as next week."
Abby shook her head. "We need several weeks, maybe months to review the test fire data before we can be sure it's safe to fire up the gateway at 100%.
"You know that and I know that," said Rosa. "And even Willie the mailboy knows that. But that's not what I'm hearing from the boss man."
"I know," grumped Abby.
"Shit."
Rosa gave her a consoling pat on the arm.
"So, what are you going to say when those politicians get here?"
"The truth."
Rosa laughed.
"The truth? Wow, what a concept. This is government contract stuff, Abby. This is private sector, not academia. No one involved in writing us funding checks wants to hear about delays. And Dr. B sure as hell doesn't want to hear that."
Abby put her palms on the sides of the hatch and hoisted herself out, quick and smooth, the way she always got out of the pool after a long swim. She was medium height, slim, and very fit. She got to her feet, slapped some of the mess off her clothes and hands.
"You look like you were mugged and left in an alley," observed Rosa.
"You are not a very nice person," said Abby, but her friend just laughed.
They both turned as the lab door opened, and her boss's voice boomed with good humor and bombast.
"And this is where the magic happens,"
Dr. Benjamin said like a ringmaster in a circus.
"If you'll come this way, Senator Hall, Senator Peng, I'd like to introduce you to our chief sorcerer."
"They're early," gasped Rosa.
Abby looked down at her soiled clothes.
"Aw, shit."
Chapter 2. The Pierce Tower, 20th Floor. Two strangers entered the lab led by Dr. Arnold Benjamin. He was 6.5 feet tall, but as thin as a stick bug. He tried for elegance in his $6,000 Brioni wool windowpane suit and $12,000 Frank Mueller Vanguard watch, but Abby knew it was a front. Benjamin's family money was boiling away thanks to his expensive tastes, and if Gateway lost its funding, his personal stock would plummet. On the other hand, if Gateway was successful, well, everyone who worked there would be able to write their own tickets, thought Abby. A successful opening of a stable threshold was, for everyone on the team, a license to print money. Two uniformed security guards trailed behind Benjamin and the strangers. They were private contractors, clearly ex-military, and a contractual requirement because of the critical nature of the project. However, Benjamin waved them away, and the guards stepped into the hall and took up stations like a pair of grim-faced statues. Dr. Benjamin spotted Abby and Rosa, but his smile faltered as he saw how begrimed his senior scientist was. It was too late to stop the tour, as the two guests came up to stand on either side of him. Abby, flushed, quickly hurried to her desk and began grabbing tissues from a box to try to clean up. She turned to the little bobblehead statue of Max Planck, father of quantum physics.
Help me, Obi-Wan, she thought. You're my only hope.
Then she plastered on her very best PR smile and turned.
Good afternoon, she said brightly as she stepped toward the small group and offered her hand.
Conrad Hall, newly appointed member of the highly secret Senate Special Projects Subcommittee, took her hand first. He was a short, round man with a nervous smile that was at odds with his bully boy handshake.
Sorry to intrude on your workday, Dr. Corman, he said. Obviously, we interrupted you doing something important.
It's Abby, and no problem at all, she said. Just making sure everything's connected where it's supposed to be.
And is it?
Oh, sure, she said after only the slightest pause. But I'm a type A personality. Have to be, you know? I like to get down and dirty and see for myself.
Hands on, said Hall, nodding.
For a moment, Abby thought it was some kind of flirty comment, but the junior senator seemed genuine, guileless.
Sorry, I didn't have time to clean up first, she said.
All good, said Hull.
Then he noticed a smear on his hand. Abby handed him a wad of tissues. He looked around like a happy puppy in a room full of squeaky toys.
This is all really pretty exciting, to tell the truth. I'm a bit of a science nerd, not like you folks who are real scientists, but I'm a kind of science junkie, or maybe a groupie, and please forgive my ignorance, but I've only just learned about this project, actually just got the clearance for this briefing and tour. Funny, you'd think being the chair of special projects, I'd already know about it, but that's the government. You don't know something until someone tells you.
Happy to answer any questions you have, said Abby.
I have about 3 zillion of them, Hall said with a laugh.
Well, I'll do my best, Abby said. You've come at a pretty exciting time. We're going to be test firing tonight. Our entire team is going over every inch of the machine to make sure it is absolutely ready.
It's encouraging to know that the staff here is actually working, said the other guest, an older woman with spiky salt and pepper hair, a dry handshake, and no-nonsense eyes. Senator Lucy Peng, chairwoman of the Special Projects Subcommittee, a hard sell even on a good day. She'd nitpicked every penny spent on the project. Abby had only met her once before, but had seen her on CNN and Fox talking about science issues. Like Hall, she was not a scientist herself, but very savvy and very sharp.
We're always working, said Abby.
Exactly, cut in Benjamin. Our team has been at it round the clock, and we are ready to pull that trigger.
Peng's eyes shifted from him to Abby. Is that right?
For the test firing, absolutely, she said.
Only the test firing, asked Peng, jumping on Abby's obvious hesitancy.
I,
began Abby, but Benjamin cut her off.
Of course, he said pompously. We test fire tonight, and then we'll be ready to go. When? Asked Hull.
Not for a few months, said Abby, but once more Benjamin hijacked the conversation.
Weeks at the most. But if the test firing goes as we expect, then maybe we can set a full test date for, next week? Yes, next week.
Abby stared at him. Next week? That was insane. The test firing, even if everything went perfectly, would require extensive analysis. Even with the banks of networked supercomputers compiling the data, it would take that long. She was aware that Peng was studying the dynamic between her and her boss. Abby could almost hear relays clicking in the senator's head. Benjamin caught it too and rattled on in his bombastic way.
We're exactly on schedule. We'll do our test fire just to dot all the I's. And then next week, we will make history. What am I saying? Make it. No, we'll change history. When we fire the gateway and establish a stable threshold, then suddenly all of the worries about dwindling resources will be gone. Poof! Just like that. Hunger gone. Overcrowding. Nations going to war over land and oil and religion. All of it gone. In a puff of smoke. And he snapped his fingers to emphasize his point. This, Abby knew from long experience, was his usual pitch. Benjamin had a PhD in particle physics, but he seemed to go out of his way not to show it. His vibe, as Abby saw it, was that of a used car salesman, and not one from a particularly upscale lot. He was the kind to hustle old Yugos and Gremlins as if they were Bentleys and Teslas. That unctuous voice and fake bonhomie.
I see, said Peng, and Abby wondered how much she did see. That's very encouraging.
Benjamin glanced at Rosa, as if suddenly realizing she was there.
Don't you have somewhere to be, Miss Rodriguez?
Yes, sir, she said and fled. Not out of fear, but because any room that Dr. Benjamin was not in was a better place to be. Benjamin knew that she was Abby's best friend and chief ally at Gateway. Rosa was also more outspoken than Abby, so Benjamin wanted her gone before she and Abby became a unified front. Hull, who seemed oblivious to the undertones of the conversation, was busy walking around Abby's workroom, looking at very ordinary computer workstations as if they were something extraordinary.
So how does this all work? He asked.
Abby said, How much have you been told? Have you read the Gateway Project report? Hull looked mildly abashed.
I've been on the subcommittee for less than 3 days. I saw your report, but it's, well, let's face it, it's a monster.
That was not an exaggeration. Abby had spent nearly a full year preparing the report. Even with single-spaced 11-point font, it filled 1,736 pages, not counting 41,000 pages of technical information. The whole report was wheeled around on a cart. She doubted that anyone had ever read all of it, except for her, Rosa, and Benjamin.
What do you know?
She asked mildly. I'm happy to fill you in on the bullet points of this.
From what I've been able to suss out, said Hull, and from some of what Lucy here told me on the way up from D.C., you guys think you've discovered a way to find another world that we can use to mine for natural resources. It's a bit more than that, said Benjamin, then launched into a variation of the speech.
The explanation he used for the unenlightened, uneducated, and unwashed, as he phrased it.
There are a number of different theories about dimensional space. Multiple universes have been hypothesized for centuries. There are attempts to explain it found in physics, cosmology, religion, and other fields. And of course, it's been deeply explored in science fiction. But don't let the fiction fool you. A lot of hardcore science fiction was written by actual scientists. Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, well, there's a long list. Depending on who is attempting to explain the concept, there are parallel worlds, parallel dimensions, alternate timelines, quantum universes, and so on. Like in those superhero movies, suggested Hull, the quantum realm.
Abby had to fight not to roll her eyes.
Very much like that, agreed Benjamin, nodding vigorously. Now, in string and superstring theory, they define multiple dimensions differently than we do here. To them, the additional dimensions are ways to measure space-time beyond the standard 3D model of height, width, and depth. Time is an accepted fourth dimension, but there are also what are known as large extra dimensions, warped extra dimensions, multiple time dimensions, and, well, you don't really want me to go into the math.
No, we don't, said Peng.
Benjamin ignored her comment.
All of that is theoretical anyway, he continued, and none of the scientists postulating those theories seems able to agree. However, when we talk about extra dimensions, we're not talking about how to map our universe. Oh, no. Nothing as mundane or, let's face it, boring as that. No, We're talking about complete universes. Our working theory has always been that there is an infinite number of other universes. A multiverse, cried Hall, like a dull child who finally knows something. But Benjamin gave him a consoling pat on the shoulder. We view it as an omniverse, truly unlimited, literally infinite. For example, there might be another Earth right next door in which the dinosaurs were never wiped out by that asteroid. There might be one where ultraviolet rays from the sun never induced reactions in the mixture of water, carbon dioxide, and ammonia that made up the primordial soup, never synthesized the amino acids that began the process of life. The possibilities are, by definition, endless.
Chapter 3. Above New York City. Outside, darkness was falling. It was still early afternoon, but the coming storm crushed the sunshine from the day, casting the entire region in a false and ugly darkness. There was just enough light trapped inside the clouds to vein them with a bloody red. The storm front was massive, stretching across the East River into Brooklyn, and then all the way past Jamaica Bay to the cold and churning Atlantic. The other end of it was still pounding Boston. The weatherman on Channel 7 had spent the morning making ominous predictions. He used his map and an electronic stylus to draw lines and lightning bolts, and a cartoon of a big and very angry cloud blowing heavy winds at the city. He made jokes about battening down the hatches and bracing for a true nor'easter. Rainfall predictions scrolled beneath him, and all of them seemed like impossible numbers. He said that odds makers were betting that the rainfall over the next 24 hours might possibly beat the record set on August 14, 2011, when 7.7 inches of rain drowned the city, clogging subways, flooding streets, and disrupting power for millions. Pop-ups showed flashback pictures of a car at a Target in Elmhurst, with floodwaters up to the windshield, and cars even more thoroughly swamped on Staten Island. "It's coming for us, folks," he said with a wicked grin, as if it was fun, as if this was something to enjoy. Thunder rumbled in the east, a growl of laughter from the storm gods. The force of it rattled every pane of glass in Manhattan, even the triple-paned, shatterproof windows of the Pierce Tower. Chapter 4. The Pierce Tower, 20th floor.
That's just incredible,
gasped Senator Hall, his eyes filled with wonder. The Gateway Initiative, said Abby, picking up the explanation, has pioneered new fields of science, particularly IDP, interdimensional physics, and we've been able to move the concept of parallel worlds out of the realm of conjecture and into that of scientific fact. At cost, said Peng. Hall glanced at her.
Well, something like this would have to be expensive, wouldn't it?
I'm not talking about the dollar amount, said the senator. She glanced at the scientists. Am I, Dr. Corman? Surely none of us can exactly forget or ignore what happened before.
Before what?
Asked Hall, looking back and forth between Peng and the others. That wasn't something Benjamin could laugh off or bluff his way through.
We are aware of the safety concerns, he said soberly.
Peng's left eyebrow rose. And yet you built your gateway in the middle of one of the most populous cities in the world.
Our gateway, yes, said Benjamin. We are not responsible for what happened in Pennsylvania or Russia, or Japan for that matter.
However, said Abby, coming to Benjamin's defense, we have studied those other gateway attempts very closely. It's fair to say that no other disasters in modern history have received the scrutiny that we've given them. My doctoral thesis was...
Yes,
interrupted Peng.
I read it.
Then you'll know why our gateway can't possibly cause the same problems. Even if, God forbid, there was a malfunction, our entire design philosophy is different.
One wonders if it's different enough,
mused Peng.
Whoa, whoa, said Hull, looking suddenly alarmed. You guys lost me around that last curve. What disasters?
Abby tried hard not to look at Benjamin. The complex history of Gateway was cluttered with mishaps and several spectacular and catastrophic failures. Her boss seemed hesitant to talk about it, so she took a breath and plunged in.
The concept of the Omniverse isn't a new one, she began. It's been theorized for centuries. Alchemists tried to discover a way to move between worlds. Some psychics and mediums believe that things like ghosts and spirits are actually beings who are glimpsed through veils, thin spots in the fabric of space-time that separates our world from others. In the early 20th century, investigations into this as a real possibility were undertaken by a number of top scientists. Even Nikola Tesla and Albert Einstein worked on it, though that is not public knowledge.
How's that a disaster, though? Asked Hull.
I have to get to that with some quick backstory, said Abby.
You see, when you are pioneering a potentially new aspect of science, there are risks. Sometimes we don't know what those risks are until something happens. A failed experiment, a surprising reaction, like that. Interdimensional physics is still in its infancy, and information sharing about it has been badly complicated by politics, national differences, and because the attempt to create a gateway has seldom been for the good of all humankind.
Until our project, amended Benjamin.
Really? Asked Hull. Who else tried this? And what happened?
Scientists of note from around the world have been working on versions of the same kind of machine for a century, said Abby. During the Second World War, Hitler's Annenerbe, a think tank of brilliant scientists in Nazi Germany, was desperate to create its own version. Project Tor, Project Gate, as it was called, had been rumored to be close to a first firing. But as the tide of World War II turned against the Germans, particularly after the Allied invasion of France, supply chains broke down. This caused substantial delays, and then time ran out as the war came to an end. It was believed that the records for Project Tor were destroyed by the Russians as they overran Berlin in 1945. However, 3 years later, reports were sent by American spies working deep in Stalin's Soviet Union that there was a similar and very secret operation known as Beskonechny Miri, Infinite Worlds.
Oh, shit, said Hull. Pang smiled faintly.
Abby nodded and continued. The Soviet program was hidden away, and even the best American and British intelligence agents were only able to find scraps. It took decades for their work to reach the point of practical testing, and, ironically, by then their own empire was crumbling. The arms race with the U.S. had pushed the Soviet Union to the edge of financial collapse. Had they successfully established a threshold, the entire USSR would never have fallen because they would have had access to unlimited resources from unpopulated parallel worlds.
In theory, said Peng.
In fact, growled Benjamin.
We'll see,
Abby said. Desperation made the Soviets push too fast and cut too many corners. Instead of doing a series of carefully controlled and analyzed test firings, they tried to go for all of it. They fired an untested gateway, and that resulted in the world's worst nuclear disaster, rated at a 7 on the International Nuclear Event Scale. Hull blinked at her.
Wait, are you talking about Chernobyl?
Yes, Abby said.
But that was an accident.
Hardly that, said Peng,
and even Benjamin nodded agreement.
The official cover story, said Benjamin, was that there was a combination of human error and systems failure at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. That story was pure propaganda to try to save face. Governments seldom like to admit that they've made big mistakes. We see that all the time.
If his remark had been intended as a mild kick in the shins to the senators, neither reacted. Abby jumped in anyway.
That catastrophe hastened the collapse of the Soviet Union, though the truth about Chernobyl was never revealed to the world. We know about it because two key Soviet scientists defected and came to work for the Department of Defense.
Early you said accidents, plural,
said Hull, looking clearly uncomfortable now.
Were there others?
Yes, admitted Abby. A similar accident, and the only other one ever rated as a 7,
occurred when the Japanese tried to use one of their nuclear plants to power another attempt. The result was one of the largest and most destructive earthquakes in human history, with a tsunami that swept across the Japanese coast and caused horrific damage to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The government, with the help of key allies, kept the truth out of the press. And so the earthquake became the central villain, with heads rolling because of some safety issues at the plant. Covert intelligence reports indicate that the Japanese were very close to establishing a stable threshold. But the process somehow affected the undersea fault lines.
It wasn't an entirely Japanese venture, I believe, said Peng. As I recall, one of your own colleagues was overseeing it. Dr. Jacqueline Sloan, yes? And I also recall that she was the original project director here. Someone you hired, Dr. Benjamin.
Dr. Sloan was and is an excellent scientist, said Benjamin. And I don't place any of the blame for Fukushima on her. Besides, she was only there in an advisory capacity.
Yet you fired her from Gateway anyway.
What choice did I have? He asked. Both governments, Japan's and ours, needed heads to roll.
Peng's eyebrow arched again.
Her head, but not yours.
I wasn't involved with Fukushima at all, said Benjamin. And I can assure you that my team here won't make those same mistakes. Not on American soil.
But Senator Peng shook her head.
You say that, Doctor, but history isn't really on your side. You skipped right over Three Mile Island.
How's TMI involved?
Asked Hull, then started to answer his own question.
No, don't tell me we...
Screwed the pooch, mused Benjamin.
Sure, in a way.
The short version of history, said Abby, is that the Russians were not the only ones to recover Project Tor materials during the fall of Berlin. American and British intelligence officers were there too. They brought those materials back here in secret, and President Truman funded the first research into our own Gateway project. In 1967, the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, secretly funded a project intended to open a gateway from our world to another. The project required massive amounts of energy, and so the first American Gateway test facility was built, hidden within the overall construction of the Three Mile Island nuclear generating station in Pennsylvania. Nearly all of the power generated by the TMI-2 reactor was used to power the Gateway project. On March 28, 1979, there was an incident resulting in the worst nuclear accident on American soil, hitting a 5 on the nuclear event scale. Benjamin nodded and added,
"The version of the story sold to the public through government spin doctors painted it as just that, an accident. Headlines screamed about it, heads rolled, movies were made, and America shuddered in fear because it was something terrifying."
"But it was a failure, too?" asked Hull. "Like Chernobyl and Fukushima."
"It was the first such disaster," said Peng. "It's only blind luck that kept it from being as big or tragic as the disasters in 1986 and 2011.
"Fukushima was the third disaster," said Abby. "But it was also the last time nuclear power was used to try to establish a threshold."
"Ours was an accident," agreed Benjamin cautiously. "But not entirely a failure."
Hull frowned.
"How not?" "Because we actually did what Russia and Japan couldn't do," said Benjamin. "We opened a gateway and created a threshold, a doorway to another world. And we maintained it long enough for the team to send probes through."
"Yes," said Peng. "And then the doorway slammed shut. All attempts to reopen the gateway failed. And because of the reactor catastrophe, no one else in America has tried. The subsequent attempts by Russia and Japan were notable disasters, resulting in catastrophic loss of life, as well as contamination of the surrounding regions. Hardly something to stand and cheer about."
"I agree entirely, Senator," Abby said, surprising everyone. "Which is why we're not using nuclear energy. We learned a lot from the TMI disaster, and we've spent 40 years figuring out what went wrong, getting those answers, and going in a completely different direction. This entire building is essentially a giant solar panel, and we have energy collectors built into the streets, powered by the passage of traffic,
and turbines in the Atlantic drawing on the constant forces of the tides. We have more energy than we need, better batteries than anything they had back in the 70s, and all of it is clean. If the threshold fails, we have a dozen fail-safes, not to mention redundancy features to ensure a steady flow of current. And, I might add, we've generated so much power that we have been selling 90% of it to Con Edison for the last 2 years. It was clear that Peng wanted to say something to dispute or refute Abby's comments, but chose not to. Instead, she gave a small and very grudging nod. Thunder suddenly boomed, proving, if anyone needed convincing, that the storm was not going to veer south of New York. Hall looked nervously at the big windows.
Are we safe in here?
He asked.
In this building?
Benjamin said with a laugh, and for once the laugh was neither fake nor forced.
The Pierce Tower was built a few years after 9/11. The architect won awards because this tower was literally designed to withstand a direct hit from a fully loaded and fueled 747. Sure, the storm may shake, rattle, and roll every place around us, but we're extremely safe right here. It exceeds code requirements for shelters. Some might say it's over-designed because the walls are thicker than they'll ever need to be, and there are structural features to allow for everything from Category 5 hurricane winds to an earthquake up to an 8.5. And even then, it would only crack the outer layers. As for the windows, you'd need high explosives to even dent them. Yes, Senator Hall, Senator Peng, we are completely safe in here.
They stood together, listening to the storm. Very well, said Peng, gesturing to the door. Let's go see this technological marvel you've constructed. They went outside, where the stone-faced security guards waited. Chapter 5. Manderley Apartments, Tribeca, Manhattan. David Bailey stood in spandex shorts and a tank top, both of which were skin tight and molded to his muscular frame. He sipped water from a plastic bottle and then used a cloth to blot his face and throat dry. On the huge flat screen that filled much of one wall of the apartment he shared with Abby Corman, 20 people were also toweling off and hydrating. None of them was in the same room, and 4 weren't even in the United States, but they were sharing the workout with him via Zoom.
Bottles and towels down, said David. Check your numbers.
Each of his students wore a slim gray wristband filled with precise sensors that threw a variety of information onto little boxes in the corner of each screen.
Jerry, he said, you're doing a lot better this week. Heart rate's much slower than it was last time. Which tells me you've been keeping at this between sessions. Props to you.
On the screen, a chubby man with thinning hair waved at the camera. He looked ready to drop, but the numbers were encouraging. Only a few of the students were really fit, though none as sculpted and toned as David. The telemetry of the screens showed past numbers, including weight, and every single one of them had moved the needles of their fitness goals toward the green. He was proud of all of them, as he was for the hundreds of students he had in dozens of classes, from absolute beginner to his ultra-advanced programs designed for competitive athletes and active military.
You guys all did great today, David told them. Bunch of badasses, every single one of you. What do we say about Deep Core? Deep Core makes you hardcore, they all chanted. You're damn right. Now hit the showers, make yourselves protein drinks, and we'll be back on Thursday for legs and lower back.
There were some groans, but smiles too, as they signed off one by one. When the last participant exited, David hit stop on the record button and then closed the conference application. His Deep Core fitness program had started as something he concocted to make a few extra bucks while he finished his MBA. But now, 3 years in, it was a global brand. It had been growing steadily, but then exploded during the months of isolation during the COVID-19 pandemic. People who'd spent weeks at home binge-watching and overeating began signing up for the online classes David launched, and the resulting social media buzz drove so much business his way that he wound up hiring several of his old Marine Corps buddies as teachers. Now he had 43 teachers and more than 1 million students. Deep Core walked that narrow line between pricey and affordable, and he threw in all kinds of bonuses, including apps, merch, and goal-based medals for accomplishments in weight loss and improved telemetric numbers. Even now, with the pandemic in the rearview mirror, Deep Core was still predominantly a virtual classroom. Most of his students were the type who couldn't stand the display window competitiveness at commercial fitness chains. He stretched his back and then walked over to the huge row of 15-foot-high windows. The sky was nearly pitch black, turning early afternoon into something approaching midnight. Lightning forked wildly in the distance, and thunder rumbled through the stone canyons of the city. David wondered how Abby was doing. Despite not being privy to many details about the government project she was running, he knew that she had a very important presentation today. Would the big nor'easter affect that? The news had been talking about power outages along the path of the storm. Sure, Pierce Tower had its own power supply, but this was going to be one real killer of a storm. He stiffened when he realized that he'd used that word in his thoughts. Killer. David touched the small tattoo on the inside of his left wrist. It was a stylized four-leaf clover. He'd gotten it in Afghanistan the day after a rocket-propelled grenade that was fired at the UH-1Y Venom helicopter he was on flew in through one open door and out the other side, missing everything and everyone. The RPG flew on to detonate harmlessly against a cliff wall, and the Super Huey, as the bird was more commonly called, fired two Hydra 70 air-to-ground rockets and blew the Taliban strike team to ash. Every man on that bird got the same tattoo, and David touched it for luck anytime there was a feeling of unease tingling in his gut. As there was now, he watched the storm walk toward Manhattan on legs of burning lightning, yelling threats in a voice of thunder. David didn't care how well-constructed Pierce Tower was. He wanted Abby home. Now. "Be safe, sweetheart," he murmured, his fingers still pressed against the lucky tattoo. Chapter 6. The Pierce Tower, Elevator Number 3. The six of them, Abby, Benjamin, the two senators, and the guards, all crowded into the elevator. Abby pressed back into a corner. "So, the whole project," said Hall as the car began to rise, "is to basically go to an identical world next door and raid their pantry?" Abby winced, then thought about it and shrugged. "Well, that's not entirely wrong. Won't the people on that other Earth mind? Isn't that us invading, like Columbus did when he came here?" "No," said Benjamin, "because there won't be people there." "How do you know?" "Oh, wait. You said something about the TMI gateway sending in some probes. Is that what you mean?" "Very good, Mr. Hull," said Benjamin, grinning. "That's exactly right. The TMI probes were able to send back a great deal of telemetry before that threshold collapsed. Air samples, ambient radiation, and quite a bit more. Even analysis of some plant and soil samples. The science teams were able to determine that the threshold did, in fact, lead to a parallel version of our own Earth, but one that is completely uninhabited."
"Well," began Abby, "that's not certain."
Benjamin's eyes seemed to stare laser death beams through her, but he managed his car salesman's smile. "The data from those probes have been studied by the greatest minds of the last four decades. The air mixture in particular was analyzed by dozens of independent labs. There were none of the pollutants you would see in any kind of industrialized culture. We tested for PMs, particulate matter made up of small airborne particles from the burning of fossil fuels by power plants, automobiles, non-road equipment, and industrial facilities. We scanned for diesel emissions and secondary particle formation from gases and vapors. There were no significant levels of nitrogen oxide or nitrogen dioxide, which are produced mainly by the transportation sector. No ground-level ozone, otherwise known as smog,
which is formed in the atmosphere through reactions of volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides, and is the result of the combustion of fossil fuels. Same goes for sulfur dioxide, which would definitely be present in the air due to the burning of fossil fuels in processes like coal furnaces, metal extraction and smelting or ship engines, and heavy equipment diesel engines burn fuels that contain sulfur. Oh, my friends, the air processed by the probe is clean. Cleaner than anything any of us has ever breathed.
Then explain the artifact, said Pang. Hall glanced at her.
Artifact? What artifact?
In a fake casual voice, Pang said, I read that there was something shiny lying in the grass near where one probe landed. How they describe it? A piece of greenish-brown material, curved and sturdy. Like maybe it was processed metal or maybe plastic. Abby saw Benjamin hide a wince.
It wasn't metal or plastic, said Benjamin decisively. Considering the stresses of that early and quite unstable threshold, it is much more likely that it was something that broke off the probe's housing. The point is that we have a good idea of what to expect when we fire our machine.
I'm no scientist, began Pang, but I know a bit about our own planet. In one of Dr. Corman's early reports, she said that there was no clear way of assessing the content of any given parallel world's biology. There could be allergens, diseases, or toxins in that other world that developed uniquely from our own. We could pollute it by contact, and more to the point, that world could pollute or infect our own.
Benjamin's smile looked very brittle, but he soldiered on.
Theoretically, yes. Which is why the threshold will be controlled. There are layers and layers of protection and filters built into Gateway. There's no open airflow between that world and ours. And we have the most sophisticated BAMS units ever designed inside the threshold.
BAMS? Asked Hull.
BAMS is short for Bioaerosol Mass Spectrometer, Abby explained. It's a device that allows for real-time detection and identification of biological aerosols, like bacillus spores, dangerous viruses, and certain vegetative cells. They have commercial models in airports to detect bioweapons like anthrax. But Dr. Benjamin is correct, and that ours is many generations more sophisticated than anything on the market. She turned to Pang. Once we establish a working threshold and can publish findings, the patent we have pending on our BAMS unit will likely recoup a great deal of the funding Congress has approved.
Benjamin nodded approval.
And should the threshold be as stable as we predict, anyone going through into that other world will wear protective gear and carry their own air supply.
His smile crept back.
No, my friends, any concerns you may have, they've already been shooed over by Abby and her assistant, Roseanne.
Rosa, corrected Abby, but Benjamin didn't appear to hear or care.
Hall glanced at the elevator display. We're climbing pretty high.
It's on the top floor of the tower, said Abby.
I thought you people always built your secret labs in dungeons, said Hull.
Well, we considered that, Abby said, lips pursed. Or the inside of a hollowed-out volcano. But that creates staffing issues.
Hull blinked.
Really?
She's joking, said Pang flatly. It's a James Bond reference. Dr. No.
Oh, right. I saw that movie,
Abby said. We needed the threshold to be above the main power grid in the city. Up here, we're above the electrical and telephone wires and the energy field surrounding substations. And this is not a joke. We did consider building our lab on top of a mountain on a remote island, but the cost of construction and labor were prohibitive.
Peng's eyes were flat.
Glad someone gave some thought to budget.
Abby wondered how much Benjamin would love to throw her out of a very high window. The elevator pinged as they reached the top floor.
Chapter 7. The Pierce Tower, fourth floor. Rosa Rodriguez sat down at her desk, leaned back, and stared at the ceiling as if she could see Abby, Dr. Benjamin, and the guests from D.C. Her cup of coffee was forgotten and already growing cold. Rosa, like her mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, was a practical scientist, but also deeply superstitious. Not truly religious, like her female forebears, but definitely the type to take certain things as omens or as signs of good luck or bad. She'd leave a heads-down penny untouched. She'd knock on wood, tossed salt over her shoulder, and crossed her fingers when a big experiment was underway. Today she'd lit candles at her mother's church, put two lucky stones in her purse, and wore an asabachi, a gold bracelet or necklace with a black or red coral charm in the form of a fist around her ankle. It wasn't that she thought something specifically bad was going to happen, but the test firing was the single most important day of her career. If things went well, she would be part of the most critical day in the history of, well, history.
"Come on, Abby," she said to the ceiling. "Knock this out of the park and let's change the world."
As she said this, Rosa reached down and touched the asabachi. She was only half aware she did it.
Chapter 8. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The Gateway Chamber. The door hissed open, and the four of them stepped into a vast chamber that filled the entire top floor of the tower. Pang and Hull gaped at what they saw. After all, it wasn't every day a person saw a machine that could change the course of human history. The gateway filled the entire room, a glittering monster of steel and crystal.
It's,
began Hull, but words failed him. The body of the machine was circular, and it filled the 28,000 square feet of the chamber, leaving space for only a small glass-walled control room and a narrow walkway. The titanic coil was made from several different metals of varying degrees of density and conductivity, though much of it was covered in curved sheets of gold. It gleamed like the wedding ring of a giant of impossible size. Bundles of heavy insulated wire were wrapped around the body of the ring. Dials and meters were bolted to the housing. In front of the ring, at the spot closest to where the small group stood, was a yawning entrance. All around this entrance were slots for many different kinds of crystals and precious stones. Flawless spears of pale quartz, precisely shaped pieces of sea-green amazonite, deep purple amethyst, smoky apophyllite, fiery unikite, charcoal gray shungite, and dozens of others. And set in a half circle around the entrance were real rubies and diamonds and other precious gems that had been cut into bizarre geometrical shapes. These were inset in sheets of gold, platinum, silver, and copper. Switches and dials were arranged in clusters on either side of the gate, and the tongue of the machine's mouth was a pad of scandium and yttrium composed in a kind of mosaic.
"My God, it's beautiful," said Hull, finally finding the word.
"Isn't it, though?" Benjamin beamed. "I think Abby achieved both form and function with this. Hell, by next Christmas, parents will be buying model kits of this for their kids. Which, come to think of it, I should get our lawyers to look into licensing rights. Toys, books, calendars, lunchboxes, some kind of app for sure." He laughed. "Maybe they'll make those Funko Pop bobblehead things of everyone on the science team."
"You guys will have science nerd groupies," agreed Hull. "I bet you'll get invited to Comic-Con."
"Personally, I'd rather go to Stockholm and pick up a Nobel Prize," mused Benjamin, a dreamy look coming into his eyes. Abby had to fight not to roll her eyes.
Benjamin said something to that effect at least 6 times a week. Abby cut a look at Pang, who stood with her arms folded tightly across her chest, lips pursed, mouth unsmiling, eyes narrowed.
"Well," she said after a long pause, "at least we can see where the money went."
"We were mindful of the budget, Senator," Abby said quickly.
"You say that," said Pang. "And yet this is all blinged out. Good God, there are more diamonds on that thing than Beyonce at the Grammys."
"It's hardly decoration," said Abby, fighting to keep defensiveness out of her voice. She ushered Pang over to the machine. "We are pioneering a new branch of science, and some of the old rules simply do not apply. IDP has its own unique design philosophy."
Benjamin grinned.
Tell them why we had to, as the senator so charmingly put it, bling out our machine.
Abby took a breath. Each kind of crystal has a different capacity for conduction, not merely in terms of load, but of frequency. As you no doubt have seen in my report of last May, we've identified and named 6 new kinds of radiation. Understand, there are the 4 types of radiation most typically encountered in science: alpha, beta, gamma, X-ray. And then there's neutron radiation in nuclear power plants and high-altitude flight, also emitted from some industrial radioactive sources. Then there are the other types of electromagnetic energy, which is also measured in waves, radio waves, microwaves, infrared, visible light rays, and ultraviolet. However, once we were able to enter the gap between dimensions, there were other kinds of radiation, which we've named flowback, webbed, swirling, dark rays, flash burst, and one that still defies understanding, chaotic.
I'm not following any of that, admitted Hull.
I'll keep it in layman's terms, Abby promised. The gateway channels all previously known forms of energy, from standard electricity through the spectrums of radiation I just mentioned to acoustic signals. We use diamonds for key functions for a number of reasons. Understand, we didn't want to use diamonds because of the cost, even industrial diamonds such as these. They're not gem quality. None of the stones are. We worked with softer stones and even ceramics of various compositions, but they could not handle the intensity. These diamonds can take the heavier energetic load, preventing burnout and system failure. Peng said nothing. Hull stood with his mouth open and a semi-vacant expression in his eyes. Also, continued Abby, since acoustics play a significant role in establishing a stable threshold, the nature of diamonds allows us to use smaller stones overall.
Why diamonds at all, though? Asked Hull.
Because, said Abby, diamonds allow for much more precise tracking of frequency modulations. They allow us to fine-tune amplitude, because the threshold is very, very precise. Even the smallest errors can cause significant problems.
Problems, echoed Peng, seizing on the word. Exactly what kinds of problems? It was my understanding that the gateway was ready to fire. She turned to Benjamin. Isn't that what you told me, Doctor?
Benjamin's expression underwent a rapid transformation from jovial to furious, but he shoved his anger down and forced his smile back into place. Maybe he was quick enough to fool Hull, thought Abby, but Peng saw it. That eyebrow crept up again.
What Abby's saying, he said firmly, is that we built it this way, with those stones to allow us to have as wide a safety margin as possible. No wider. This machine is ready to go, I can assure you. Isn't that right, Abby?
Abby forced herself not to reply. In fact, she tried very hard to teleport to the far side of the moon rather than answer. Luckily, there was another massive burst of thunder, which gave her a few seconds of stalling time. Peng's eyes were like burning lasers, and she could feel Benjamin's anger swirling in the room. Once we do our test fire tonight, we'll analyze the data, and if everything is in the green, we'll set a reasonable date for
tomorrow,
said Benjamin, cutting her off. Abby gaped at him. What?
The test firing will confirm what we already know,
Benjamin said slowly and forcefully.
And that means we can fire the full system tomorrow.
Peng's eyebrows went up again, this time both of them.
And do you agree, Dr. Corman?
Suddenly the entire world was a microscope, and Abby felt like a paramecium caught between 2 plates of glass.
Tomorrow, insisted Benjamin firmly. No doubt about it.
Abby cleared her throat. She glanced away from them to the machine, stalling in hopes of coming up with some kind of an answer that wasn't going to start World War III. If any of the windows could open, she would have gladly thrown herself out of one.
I'm sure the test firing will support Dr. Benjamin's.
But her voice trailed off. She couldn't do it. She could not bring herself to support what her boss just said.
Abby stood there, unable and unwilling to meet anyone's eyes.
"And you're confident it's safe to open this door?" said Peng.
"Why wouldn't it be?" asked Benjamin before Abby could respond. "It's a parallel world, not alien. We're not trying to reach Mars. This is a world only slightly removed from ours."
Peng's shrewd eyes studied Abby.
"It's clear you and Dr. Benjamin disagree as to whether the gateway is ready to fire," she said. "Tell me why."
Abby began to speak, but again Benjamin cut her off.
"Aside from being one of the most brilliant scientists of our age, Senator, Abby is also the most cautious. She is a pure scientist, if you understand what I mean by that. If she had her way, she'd be testing and retesting the gateway for 10 years, and even then she'd prefer a decade or two to process the results."
"I," began Abby, but she caught Benjamin's brief, fierce glare and backed down.
"I know we're ready," said her boss. "We've done every possible test over and over, and we are ready to go."
Chapter 9. Manderley Apartments. David Bailey found himself pacing the apartment from the front door to the big picture windows and back, over and over, prowling like a caged tiger. He wasn't even sure why. It was storm season, so this wasn't anything particularly rare, even if the sky looked like something out of a painting of the apocalypse. Still, he kept wishing he could call Abby. For the last 2 weeks, she'd been getting increasingly tense, anxious. Whatever today's big presentation was all about, she was unusually agitated, losing sleep, and long moments where she would suddenly go still and kind of stare off in the general direction of the Pierce Tower. This morning, David had come out of the bedroom to find her standing by the window. Leaning so close, each exhale steamed a small patch. He stood a dozen paces away, watching her.
"Are you okay, babe?"
he asked. Abby flinched, then took a long time to reply. "I'm fine."
"You sure?"
Another long pause. "I'll be fine." That extra word, "be," changed what she'd said. She was nervous about something and would be fine, but she wasn't all that fine right then.
"The project?"
he asked. He knew that it was called the Gateway Initiative, but that was all. Abby preferred just calling it the project or work. Her reply was a nod.
"Can I help?"
he asked, moving closer but still not touching her. Abby had looked out at the morning sky, at the storm clouds just beginning to gather in the distance. She took a deep breath, held it, and exhaled a long sigh. Then she turned and came to him, reaching for him, letting herself be pulled into his embrace, laying her head against the muscular wall of his chest.
"Just be here for me," she said.
"I am, Abby," David promised.
"Now and always."
Abby stood on her toes to kiss him. It was a good kiss, tentative and almost shy at first, but then deepening into something sweet and hungry. They stood there, lips pressed, tongues dancing, hands gently caressing each other's shoulders and backs. The kiss lasted for a long time, a beautiful, timeless time. And then Abby pushed back, smiled at him, and left for work. That was hours ago. The storm had grown into a monster, and Abby hadn't called or texted, not once, which was rare for her. He was not allowed to call her during work hours, one of the many security requirements tied to Gateway. He couldn't visit either, because David was no longer military and had no security clearance. He was a fitness coach, a mountain climbing coach, and a jock. He wasn't part of her world. Not that aspect of her world, at least. It hurt to be on the outside, especially at a time when whatever she was doing at work was causing her this much stress. He wished the phone would ring. It stubbornly refused to do so. And so he paced and paced and paced, while outside the storm grew bigger and more savage. Chapter 10. The Pierce Tower, Ground Floor.
The tour was done, and the guests were escorted down to the lobby and then out to their waiting limo. Rain was falling steadily, well in advance of the storm front, and the wind whipped torn newspapers past them like ghosts hurrying to flee town. Security guards popped open umbrellas for the dignitaries. Hull got into the car right away, but Pang lingered for a moment under the tower's awning. She took the umbrella from the guard and waved him off, then bent close to talk with Benjamin just beyond Abby's earshot. From their body language and expressions, it was clear they were not having a friendly chat.
"Shit," Abby murmured, knowing that no good could come of this.
Pang turned away sharply and got into the back seat of the limo. Before she closed the door, she gave Abby a small, cold, unpleasant smile. Then the car was gone.
"That didn't go too badly," Abby said as her boss turned toward her.
But Benjamin seemed to swell in size, all smiles gone, face turning a fiery red. He towered over her, fists balled at his sides, eyes blazing.
"My office," he said sharply. "Now."
He pushed roughly past Abby, went inside, and did not even bother to hold the door for her.
"Oh, shit,"
said Abby as the wind whipped rain at her.
"Shit, shit, 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 shit."
The rain fell harder, transforming from a drizzle to a downpour with such intensity, it was as if the sky itself wanted to wash her away. She went in and found the lobby empty. One of the two elevators was already ascending. Abby wished she was working on a teleporter project instead, because right then, she'd have preferred to be on the far side of the planet, given what she assumed was going to be a comprehensive reprimand.
"Mom wanted me to be a dentist," she told the empty lobby.
She got into the second elevator, and once inside, she pushed the button for the 22nd floor. Then she leaned her forehead against the wall as the car rose. Her stomach seemed to be filled with icy slush, and her fingers were cold. Fear, dread, and a sense of despair, because there was no way the next few minutes were going to be anything but hell.
Chapter 11. The Pierce Tower, 22nd floor. Dr. Arnold Benjamin sat behind his desk, looking less like a car salesman and much more like the man who operated the guillotine in the Paris Square during the revolution. He did not invite Abby to sit. Instead, he slammed his palm flat down on his desk with such force that coffee leaped from his cup and sloshed over a stack of folders. Benjamin did not seem to care. His face was still livid, and his lips were pulled into tight white lines.
"What in the hell were you thinking?"
he roared, but didn't let her reply.
"We are test firing tonight, Dr. Corman, and now you've endangered everything."
Dr. Corman. Not Abby. Oh, shit, she thought. Then suddenly, Benjamin smiled. It was an ugly, crooked, insane smile that ignited weird lights in his eyes.
"Do you know what Senator Pang told me before she got into her car?"
he said in a voice of mock joviality.
"Should I tell you?"
Abby did not dare utter a word, not a sound.
"Senator Pang said that she was happy you shared your concerns so candidly. Happy. She said she was happy."
Abby said nothing. The smile grew and grew until it was a manic leer.
"Senator Pang said she is considering shutting us down, pending a congressional review of our safety protocols. Did you hear me? Shutting us down."
I...
"You've endangered not only this project, but our professional careers. You've put decades of research at risk, not to mention the humiliation that will be heaped on my head. If she succeeds in shutting us down, even for a week, then my career is over. If we lose Gateway,